Peter B. Collins. News and comment. It's Friday, May 27th, 2016. Barack Obama delivered mixed messages on an historic visit to Hiroshima, Japan today. Our opening music from the Canadian band Rush. This is called Manhattan Project.
Imagine a time when it all began. In the dying days of a war, a weapon that could settle the score. Whoever found it first would be sure to do their worst. We always had before.
And for those who don't recall or weren't there, the Manhattan Project was the super-secret effort to develop a nuclear weapon during World War II. And the product of that, the result? Well, two bombs were dropped, one in Hiroshima, one in Nagasaki, in August of 1945. The carnage was immense, more than 100,000 people killed in Hiroshima alone. And so I have mixed feelings about President Obama making this historic visit to Hiroshima today. The optics were good. The intention, I think, was good. But the message was quite mixed. He gave a speech where he said that we need a moral revolution. And that sounds good. But there were echoes of his bizarre speech when he accepted the Nobel Peace Prize back in 2009. Justifying war as he promotes peace. So the president didn't apologize to the Japanese, as had been promised before he made the visit. But he did defy some expectations and meet with survivors of the Hiroshima bombing, and that produced some touching moments. A 91-year-old man held his hand and wouldn't let go for quite some time. His name was Sunao Suboi. He is chairman of the Hiroshima branch of the Japan Confederation of A and H bomb sufferers organizations. And so that kind of personal diplomacy, that touch, is something that I find valuable. And I don't dismiss out of hand the intentions of the president. But the message was so mixed as he started to talk about how Japan was to blame for the war, and that war in general is almost inevitable, at least in his opinion. And so it really was a truly mixed message, where he could have taken a much more demonstrative position. He could have announced efforts to, for example, further reduce America's nuclear arsenal. Because just yesterday, a new report, a census of America's nuclear arsenal, was released by the Federation of American Scientists, and it shows that Barack Obama has reduced the nuclear stockpile less than any other Cold War president. The lack of recent progress in both arms control and warhead dismantlement seems to coincide with the administration's push for sweeping modernization of the nuclear arsenal, expected to cost up to $1 trillion over the next 30 years. And so, what is the true expression of Barack Obama? The optics, the pictures, the words, or the actions? Well, President Obama has dismantled only a handful of warheads. It was 109 in 2015. The stockpile has been reduced by only 13% since he became president. And if you're keeping track, we currently have 4,571 nuclear warheads. My friend David Swanson, who has a new edition of War is a Lie, just published, and he's on the West Coast this weekend doing a bookstore tour. He'll be a guest on the program in the next few weeks. And he published a piece I'm linking to for your convenience. You can click over to peterbcollins.com in the show file. And he describes it as Obama painting a peace sign on a bomb. He said Obama claimed that he wanted to eliminate nukes, but he declared that such a thing couldn't happen for decades, probably not in his lifetime. And quoting the president again, "We may not be able to eliminate man's capacity to do evil, so nations and the alliances that we form must possess the means to defend ourselves." He went on, "But among those nations like my own that hold nuclear stockpiles, we must have the courage to escape the logic of fear and pursue a world without them. We may not realize this goal in my lifetime, but persistent effort can roll back the possibility of catastrophe." And Swanson, as I just did, notes that it's echoing the first ever pro-war Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech back there in 2009. And then Swanson goes into argument mode. He says there's nothing inevitable about war. Humans have been on the planet for about 10,000 years, and war has been sporadic. He says war is optional, not inevitable, for women and men alike. And he argues that the culture of capitalism, or a particular type and degree of greed and destruction and short-sightedness, is a driver that necessitates war. So I'll link to his piece, and I encourage you to read it. And as we think about this moment, we also have to look at the mixed message the president sends, where he doesn't even talk about the hot wars in the Middle East, and the fact that is now confirmed that American troops that are called advisors, that are there to advise and assist Syrian Democratic Forces, who the hell is that? We don't know who these people are that we're fighting alongside, and a photographer, I believe for a French publication, Agence France Presse, captured pictures in the village of Fatissa that were released yesterday, showing American commandos dressed in camouflage assisting fighters with the Syrian Democratic Forces. Now, they are assisting. In this picture, they're sitting right next to the guy who's got his hand on a 50-caliber machine gun mounted on the back of a pickup truck. And so, while the Pentagon spins this up as advise and assist, these are armed Americans who are in combat. And there is no debate about it. There's no pushback. It's kind of whatever from the American people. Trump occasionally had raised issues about the folly of America's interventions in the Middle East, but he's too focused on his Twitter wars these days, and we'll get to him in a few minutes. But this is critical mission creep, and there is no pushback. When Bush was president, the Democrats opposed it. But with Obama's wars, the Republicans tacitly approve, the Democrats grind their teeth, and the wars continue. And meanwhile, we have deployed troops in three different African nations. Now, we're told that they're just conducting training exercises with government fighters. But just this week, we had U.S. Army troops in Burkina Faso. In Kenya, American trainers funded by the State Department have been working with police commandos on how to respond to terrorist attacks. And next month in Gabon, paratroopers from the 82nd Airborne are scheduled to jump out of a plane and straight into a joint exercise, part of an effort to train Central African militaries. So Obama has dramatically expanded the footprint of American forces since he won that Nobel Peace Prize. And it undermines the credibility of the statement, both, you know, in speech and in action, that he attempted to make in Hiroshima today. And meanwhile, the consequences of the Middle East wars continue. More than 7,000 refugees who were trying to cross the Mediterranean had to be rescued just since Monday. That's right, over 5 days, 7,000 people were on ships that were foundering, little rubber rafts with too many people on them. And there's one really graphic scene that was broadcast on the PBS NewsHour last night. And an Italian ship had a stationary camera that was trained to one side, where a boat that had some 562 people on it was foundering. And this is tragic. It happens so often when you have a crowd of people on a ship that is foundering. They will run from side to side, hoping that they can right the ship. But it was the human action trying to do that that actually caused the ship to roll over and capsize, and more than 20 people were killed in that incident alone. And what has happened is because Europe has shuttered its borders and paid the Greeks to send people back to Turkey, where they're paying the Turks to hold on to people in concentration, in refugee camps. Well, all that's happened is the porous borders of the failed state of Libya, failed because of U.S. intervention taking out Muammar Gaddafi. That is the transit point where many people are embarking for Europe right now, and it is extremely risky and dangerous. Back in Washington, a couple of really bad bills on Capitol Hill, and yesterday as Congress bolted for a two-week vacation. Now, I know it's an election year, and that's why they're not in session as often. But the Republicans are so intent on pandering to their right-wing conservative religious base about the fear struck into the hearts of so many Americans by transsexual individuals. And as Democrats inserted an amendment to try to ban discrimination against LGBTQ persons, House Republicans voted against their own bill, which was a routine energy and water spending bill. It went down by a vote of 305 to 112. Only a handful of Democrats voted for it, and Speaker Paul Ryan, whose own colleagues of the Republican side had deserted him, blamed the Democrats. And what is here at the heart of this is that the Republicans are taking a stand for discrimination, claiming that protecting the rights of LGBTQ persons violates their religious freedom. And this is becoming a really annoying routine over bathrooms, over anti-discrimination laws. And the bottom line here is that Republicans believe that they have a right to discriminate because they feel creepy when they think about a transgender person. And it's all about them, not about the rights of these individuals. The other bad bill on Capitol Hill right now is trending through the Senate. It passed the Intelligence Committee with only one vote against it, and it would expand the scope of national security letters. Now, I've railed about this ever since the Patriot Act was passed. It gave the right to FBI agents and other law enforcement officials to essentially write their own warrants. They don't need to go to a judge. It's not issued by any third party. And the FBI can simply say, hey, Peter, we want to see your computer records. Well, currently, that would require a warrant. And the Fourth Amendment is very clear. It requires probable cause and a court order. But in a sneaky move at the Intelligence Committee, they're trying to insert language that would allow the use of national security letters to access, quote, electronic communications transaction records. And this is a dangerous expansion of surveillance here in the United States. And to his credit, Martin Heinrich, a Democratic senator from New Mexico, said that the bill does not clearly define. I'm sorry, I'm not reading the right quote here. First, we have Ron Wyden from Oregon. While this bill does not clearly define electronic communications transaction records, it could easily be read to encompass records of individuals exchanging emails and, as well, their login history, IP addresses, internet browsing history. Then Heinrich of New Mexico said that this represents a massive expansion of government surveillance that lacks independent oversight and potentially gives the FBI access to Americans' email and browser histories with little more than the approval of a manager in the field. Heinrich went on, the FBI has not made a convincing case that it needs any process other than the one that already exists. And I would argue that the widespread abuse of the national security letters has been routinely confirmed by the Justice Department Inspector General. Nevertheless, the FBI issues an average of 60 national security letters a day, and many of them include gag orders that prohibit them from contacting a lawyer or telling anybody else about the demands of the government to see private information. It's really frightening. And it continues. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. And what I do is I print out a list from recent PayPal activity and identify key people like Timothy McKay, who succeeded in getting past the technical obstacles to access his subscription here at peterbcollins.com, Carla Mahoney, Susan Gavet, and Joe Carson, all monthly subscribers to the Peter B. Collins podcast. It's your turn to join in. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button, and then you click on Become a Subscriber, and it takes you to the sign-up page where the bonus books are displayed for new annual subscribers who give me a mailing address inside the United States. And I welcome your support to keep this operation going. It's been a tough year. I've lost a number of subscribers because of my strong opinions about the current presidential race. And Henry Garciga emailed yesterday saying that my new interview about Scientology is guaranteed to alienate even more people. But that's the work I do, and I don't think twice about it. But I do encourage you, if you find this to be a useful product for you, this podcast, come on over and subscribe at peterbcollins.com. And ladies and gentlemen, cue the applause, please. In the Kickstarter campaign for newsbud.com, we are now over the $100,000 mark by $100. That's it. We have 100 grand and 100 bucks from 776 contributors so far. And this weekend, I'm going to be releasing a new video message. It'll be up on Facebook and other social media where I show you the changes we've made to my secret studio to record video here on a weekly basis for the new NewsBud report that I'll be anchoring. It will be a video report. We worked out some of the bugs in our system yesterday and recorded a great interview with Bob Fetrakis and Cliff Arnbeck, the election protection advocates from Columbus, Ohio. So we are underway to bring NewsBud to reality, and we need to get to $150,000. So another 50 grand, we're two-thirds of the way there. So go to newsbud.com, share that link with your friends and people who you know want a new independent media outlet, and then link over to the Kickstarter page and do whatever you can to help us reach our goal. Well, I am confused because, you know, originally Bernie Sanders tried to get Hillary Clinton to honor her pledge to debate in California before our June 7th primary. And Hillary, who claims she's already got the nomination wrapped up, despite the fact that it's not over, she's certainly trending to capture the nomination. Everybody can see that. But the race is not over. And yet she has declined to debate Sanders. So via the diplomat Jimmy Kimmel on late night ABC, Sanders delivered a message to Trump. And Trump initially said he would debate Sanders, then he said he'll only do it for $10 million. And it sounds as if he expects Bernie Sanders to pay that money to Donald because Donald is such a superstar and the ratings will be through the roof. And I don't get it. You know, networks don't pay participants to debate who are political candidates. And Trump seems to think that he is so special and so popular and powerful and irresistible that people would pay $10 million. Now, this is bullshit, clearly, but it is a strange gambit. And it's also interesting to see that Sanders is pursuing a discussion with Trump's people to try to set this up. But meanwhile, Hillary's echo chamber tells us that this is a dangerous move by Bernie Sanders. He is disloyal. He should sit down, shut up, and get out of the race. And the reliable repeater of the talking points from the Clinton campaign is Jason Easley. I told you about the website yesterday. It's Politicus USA, not Politics USA, Politicus USA. And every day there is a post by Jason Easley that is consistent with the Clinton campaign. So now he writes, Democratic senators are unloading on Bernie Sanders for courting a debate with Donald Trump. He quotes Joe Manchin, the right-wing Democrat from West Virginia. Bullshit. That confirms what we've been saying. Why would you expect Bernie should be considerate or be nice or be working to bring everyone together? Why? He's not a Democrat. Well, he is campaigning to win the election. And even though the numbers are against him, it's not over, and he's doing what candidates do. Then they quote Gary Peters, Democrat from Michigan in the Senate. I don't know why he would do that. I think it's time to start winding down the primary. Well, it isn't over. We haven't voted in California, Senator Peters. And then I'm disappointed to see Sherrod Brown, Democrat from Ohio. It's peculiar. It's all about Bernie trying to get the advantage in California. It's not going to work. Well, then Jason Easley delivers a threat that, gosh, you know, Sanders is going to have to go back to the Senate, and he ought to play nice. And as if that's not enough, the other echo chamber commentary comes from Christopher Barron in The Guardian today. Headline, is Bernie Sanders making a Trump presidency more likely? And what he's doing here is blaming Sanders for the weaknesses of candidate Clinton. And in three different places, he uses the word attacks to describe the campaigning that Sanders is doing and describing his differences with candidate Clinton. But when you take on Hillary, she's a victim, you're an attacker. And when you talk about issues where you have very different positions in order to educate voters, that is an attack, or on the final paragraph, a withering attack. And I just find this bizarre. And they're clearly trying to persuade the American people that it's all over. And it'll be over in the middle of June. Not too long to go. But they're impatient because they fear that they might lose somehow. And a lot of it relates to Hillary's vulnerability on the email issues. And in my opinion, the Clinton Foundation is a second vulnerability. But Hillary yesterday was kind of doing a Trump thing. She was making phone calls to media outlets, and she kept repeating what is a lie. She said that having her private email server was allowed. That's what she told CNN, quote, well, it was allowed, and the rules have been clarified since I left about the practice. She said, having said that, I've said many times it was a mistake, but she is stubbornly unwilling to acknowledge what the State Department Inspector General said, that it wasn't allowed, and that she didn't ask, and if she had asked, they would have said no, and there was a directive to staff members not to talk to Secretary Clinton about her private email server and to never bring it up again. And just yesterday, we've learned that out of all these emails that have been bounced back and forth, and some were culled and some were published, an agency audit over at the State Department determined that three emails had never been seen before. One of them includes Clinton's own explanation of why she wanted to keep her emails private. It was from November of 2010. And they also found two other emails in which she worried that her personal messages could become accessible to outsiders, and that there are possible security weaknesses in the home email system that she used. So this shows the selective culling of her emails. And she says, you know, I've released all my emails. That's not true, because she sat on her emails for 2 years and her staff went through them and eliminated about 30,000 of them, saying they were private or, you know, not public information. Those are not determinations that she or her people should have been making. And it remains a very serious situation. Gerald Nadler is a no-nonsense congressman from New York, a Democrat who covers Lower Manhattan and a few other areas. I've interviewed him many times, and he's completely humorless. I tried to crack a joke with him one time, and he was just kind of, next. But Gerald Nadler has set his sights on Donald Trump, and he wrote him a scathing letter saying that Trump has exploited the darkest day in New York history, 9/11, because the Trump Organization took $150,000 in grant money that was intended for small businesses that were hammered by the events of 9/11 in Lower Manhattan. Now, Trump or his company owns a building at 40 Wall Street. It employed 28 people. It had $26 million in annual revenues. He claimed it was a small business and took a $150,000 payout. Nadler? In grabbing that money with both fists, you took it out of the pockets of small business owners in New York who were truly hurting and prevented them from taking full advantage of the relief so generously offered by their fellow citizens. And he pointed out that Trump had later been quoted in a television interview saying, "None of my properties were harmed in the 9/11 attacks." But he took the money. There's a powerful essay that I just found out about that was published back in February by a PhD candidate from Harvard named Nathan J. Robinson. It was published in Current Affairs, and I'm linking to it in the show file for this podcast. The headline reads, "Unless the Democrats run Sanders, a Trump nomination means a Trump presidency." And this is a prescient analysis. Again, it was written in February. He writes, "Instinctively, Clinton has long seemed by far the more electable of the two Democratic candidates. But a Clinton matchup with Trump is highly likely to be an unmitigated electoral disaster, whereas a Sanders candidacy stands a far better chance. Every one of Clinton's considerable weaknesses plays to every one of Trump's strengths, whereas every one of Trump's few weaknesses plays to every one of Sanders' strengths. From a purely pragmatic standpoint, running Clinton against Trump is a disastrous, suicidal proposition." I couldn't have said it better. And he also adds here, "Every Democrat should take time to fairly, dispassionately examine Clinton's track record as a campaigner. Study how the 08 campaign was handled, how this one has gone. Assess her strengths and weaknesses with as little bias or prejudice as possible. I wish that were the case, but her supporters are so emotional, they're not willing to examine it rationally." And here's a final pull quote. "Sanders is thus an almost perfect secret weapon against Trump. He can pull off the only maneuver that's capable of neutralizing Trump, ignoring him, and actually keeping the focus on the issues. Sanders will have the advantage of an enthusiastic army of young volunteers. The Sanders team is extremely technically skilled. Everything from their TV commercials to their rally organizing is pulled off well. The Sanders team is slick and adaptable. The Clinton team is ropey and fumbling." Earlier this week, I talked about the mess at the airports and the airport security theater charade. There are new stats here that show that more than 70,000 Americans, more than 70,000 customers of American Airlines alone have missed their flights this year. 40,000 checked bags failed to be loaded because of airport screening delays. And this is against a backdrop where airline traffic has increased by 15%, but the TSA cut its staff by 12%. Now, this is totally unacceptable. And as I have pointed out, the whole issue about airport security is this play that everybody has to participate in. You can't joke. You got to follow the rules. You got to get groped. And then you can get on a plane. Despite the fact that 95% of the test weapons that go through airport security checkpoints are not discovered. And so this is out of control. But our public officials will not acknowledge that this emperor has no clothes. And we're just going to have to, I guess, show up at the airport early and spend more money at airport concessions behind the checkpoints. A new survey by Rasmussen shows that the public is getting frustrated. The rate that the public says the airline security process is good or excellent has declined from 56% to 37% in the last 5 years. 39% of travelers who go out more than once a month say airport security is poor. Only 30% of all Americans rate the TSA favorably, and the rest are kind of lemmings, I guess. And 60% have an unfavorable opinion of the security agency. So they're not lemmings. They have figured out that there's something wrong here. But people are way too passive and just accept it. The other vulnerability at our airports includes the perimeter. And the Associated Press has conducted an investigation documenting 345 airport perimeter breaches between about the last 10 years or 11 years. So it's a minor issue, but it is a nagging problem. And a lot of it appears to be just opportunists or crazy people who say, there's a fence there. I wonder if I can scale it. Also over at the troubled Department of Homeland Security, 41 members of the U.S. Secret Service have been disciplined for their role in leaking the personal files of Jason Chaffetz. Chaffetz is the Republican congressman from Utah. I'm no fan of his, but he's right about this. He chaired the Committee on Oversight and Government Reform when they led a probe into the Secret Service, and members of the Secret Service responded by leaking something to embarrass Chaffetz. It turns out that he had applied for a job at the Secret Service back in 2003 before he got elected to Congress, and they found him unqualified. Finally today, you ever perform the Heimlich maneuver? Somebody's choking and you get behind them and, get both hands under the rib cage and pop. Well, it's named after Dr. Henry Heimlich. And yesterday, for the first time at a retirement home in my hometown of Cincinnati, the retired surgeon, Dr. Heimlich, got to perform his maneuver in a real-life case for the very first time. One of his co-inhabitants at the Dupree House retirement community was in the dining room, and this 87-year-old woman began choking. So Heimlich went over and squeezed her in the right way and dislodged a piece of hamburger to prevent her from choking. Thanks for joining me today for my news and comment. You're free to share this podcast with absolutely everyone. So, hey, get on it, will you? Have a great weekend. I'll be back on Tuesday right here at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.